My name's Red, and I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here, and I'm glad to be sober. Don't let the watch scare you. It just proves that I've been around long enough to afford one. First, I want to thank the committee for inviting us down here. I personally have had nothing but a real good weekend, and I feel good about it. I feel comfortable standing up here. A little bit nervous, and I always say to every speaker I know of, if you're not nervous, I'm going to start worrying about you. But we share your day a little bit of what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. What it was like, well, I'm here to tell you I was a booze-drinking redneck. Today, I'm just a sober redneck. So some of the things I may talk about, you might not agree with. If that be the case, forget about it. But if I can happen to say something that you can something you can loosen your sobriety, for God's sake, feel free to use it. I only have one request, and that is you pass it on. Pass it on to that drunk who wants to quit drinking. Or else pass it on at a meeting where somebody wants to stay sober. Lots of things I'll talk about that you might not agree with. It is a little different than what we are, with the same results. We go one day at a time without having a drink. We go one day at a time at trying to prove our sobriety. And that's some of the good things. I haven't got a very long drunkalog, but I'd like to share a little bit with you about it. You see, I drank a lot of Canadian Club whiskey. But you know all that that Canadian Club did for me? It made me a connoisseur of fine wines. Probably the best was Clona Red Dry. You know that stuff, $4 a gallon. Not these little American gallons, that's imperial gallons. You know where you put your fingers through that hole in the neck of the bottle and you sling it over your shoulder and just let it run down. Well, that's just about where that Canadian Club whiskey took me to. And so consequently, I went for quite some time wanting to quit drinking and didn't know how. But you know, the thing is that, like I say, with the want to quit drinking and not knowing how, I know that today there's going to be quite a few people here who come out of treatment centers, who come out of detoxes. Where we came from, we detoxed in grubby hotel rooms, and usually our treatment centers were in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So some things that I may talk about, I know nothing about, you know. And the only thing is, I found out that today most of the people who come to our groups, they come from treatment centers, and I know darn well that I have to be there to bridge the gap. I have to make these people feel welcome, and I find out the good work that outside places can do a very good job of getting people sober too. I prefer that they come strictly to Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's strictly my opinion. And you see, today, though, I'm going to talk a little bit about this book. I'm a firm believer in this book. I've had a lot of people talk about the 164 pages of recovery in here. When they talk that way to me, I have to shake my head and say no. My big book starts right on the front cover. And you know, I was just out there. This book is not that old. It just looks it. And I was out there putting a little bit of scotch tape on it, and somebody says, oh, no, that cover's had it. You might as well take it off. Not for me. When I have to take this cover off, I hope that I find a new big book somewhere. Every big book I seem to get lately, though, I'm fortunate enough to give it to somebody. The reason I say I keep the cover on, because what it states on the very front, this is the third edition of the big book, the basic text for Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, it's very important that I read that every day, because I believe in carrying this message. I don't believe in carrying the message. I carry this message, this message here. So there's a few things in here that apply to me. They may not apply to you, but they apply to me. And a lot of people talk about that 164 pages of recovery, and I say it starts in the cover, and there's a lot in this book before I get to page one. That's one part I like to read quite often. We as Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. So sometimes when I see other books around the meetings that I go to, I have to really get back to them and let them know about the part I believe that no other authentication is necessary. Now, I don't say that works for everybody, but here I am sharing with you my story and you know how it happened to me, and it happened very much. See, I drank a lot. I never got too much trouble when I was drinking. I had social misbehaviors, and this is a few in here. Social misbehaviors too, you know. But I never murdered anybody, never raped anybody, and you know, I thought I was doing okay. You know, but by having these things happen and drinking and getting in trouble, that was the name of the game. And it started when I was very young. Started when I was a teenager. I used to walk around with a pit in my stomach, and I didn't feel very good about doing things in general living. And lo and behold, the day came that I had a drink. And my, how that would change. And I didn't realize it, but at that time, from the very first drink that I had, there was something different with me than most people. Because right from the time I was a young teenager, I used to drink to oblivion. Not knowing why, it just happened. Once I had a drink, it was usually oblivion on its way. And the thing is, you have to excuse me, I seem to have an awful frog in my throat or something. But anyway, with these things happening to me, I didn't pay much attention to them. And again, a lot of people, they explained to me at meetings how they had a lot of trouble when they were drinking. A lot of problems. And it's funny. Once I had a drink, things didn't bother me. Coming off drunk, that's when the trouble started with me. Any time that I had problems, and I never hallucinated once while I was drinking. Matter of fact, I got rid of the hallucinations by having a drink. But, you know, in between drunks, sitting there, music was coming out of the walls, and the wallpaper was moving around. You know, just not too long after I quit drinking, they come up with that spirograph wallpaper. Hell, I seen that 10 years before it was invented. And the loneliness, it never hit me while I was drinking. I could be right out on Main Street, as loud and just boisterous as could be. In between drunks was a different story. That's when I learned to walk down alleys. That's when I learned to avoid people. So consequently, as the drinking went on, I found that I was really sick physically. Now, a lot of people, I meet a lot in the program who never had a hangover. Holy crap. That sure wasn't me. You know, I was born with them, I think. And I was deathly sick, drunk. Spiritually, I didn't know a thing. I kind of thought that I was an atheist. I had never gone to Sunday school when I was young. I never went to church when I was young. Wouldn't know any prayers when I was young, and had a horrible hang-up with organized religion. Where that came from, I don't know. I think it was a fear. See, when I don't know something, when I don't know anything about something, I get scared. You know, and usually I retaliate. And I had this horrible hang-up with religion. So consequently, I tried a lot of different avenues to quit drinking, except for religion and except for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's funny, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here. There was pamphlets laid around my house for 2 or 3 years, and I can remember grabbing them and crunching them up and throwing them in the garbage and saying, how can anybody insinuate? What makes them think that I'm an alcoholic? I didn't mind being a town drunk. Of course, we lived in a small town. But I didn't really think I was an alcoholic. And then the day came, my wife talked about it yesterday. I was working in Midway, B.C., which is about 300 miles from our home. And we're living in a little 16-foot homemade trailer. Not to tell you what the circumstances were like. And I was working up there, and at that time I was a daily drinker. I drank every day, most days drank to oblivion. Still worked though. That's an amazing thing. I still worked. And the day came that we went to a beer parlor. We didn't have pubs then, we had beer parlors, and we went to a beer parlor in Greenwood, B.C. And the table was just loaded with beer and bottles of wine. The first time in British Columbia I've seen anything in a beer parlor outside of beer. It's bottles of wine. They just changed the law and they were there. And it was a wind-up party for the company that I worked for. And we had good production on that company, so they were buying the beer. And the hotel where I spent most of my time, they were buying these bottles of wine. And I walked into this beer parlor with my wife, which was not the usual thing that was happening at that time. We'd been married for 18 years then. And it wasn't that we hung around together too much. Anyway, I went into that beer parlor and a funny thing happened to me. And I turned to her and said a thing I said hundreds of times before. I said, you know, I think I'll quit drinking. And she said something that was unusual at that time. She says, why don't you? And, you know, I just got up and I walked outside of that beer parlor and I stood in the sidewalk and I had no idea what was going to happen. None at all. And I stood out on that sidewalk and a thought came to me. I knew this girl from Cache Creek. Yep, we lived in Ashcroft, just a little bit out of Cache Creek. And I knew this girl who had quit drinking 18 months previous. And I didn't know how. She was a girl that we used to go on real benders. You know, and she'd quit drinking and she seemed to change. So the thought came to me, well, I better go home 200 or 300 miles and find out how she quit drinking. One thing I forgot about, though, is her and her husband, Tom, had moved the opposite direction 200 or 300 miles. But anyway, I loaded up the kids and wife and just hooked onto the 16-foot homemade trailer and headed back to Ashcroft, where we'd lived at the time. And lo and behold, when I drove down the hill into Ashcroft, the very first car I met on the bridge was Tom and Rhonda. They had just come back from for a weekend from Golden, which was 300 miles the other way. And I flagged them down and I said, Rhonda, I says, something's wrong. I says, I'm dying. I says, what can you do? How did you quit drinking? And she says, well, there's only one way I know how to quit drinking, and that was to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I says, what? She says, I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting? And I was pretty desperate because I said, yes. But the meeting wasn't until the next day. And the funny thing, I went up to that school in Cache Creek, where the Cache Creek group meets. That's still my home group today. And I walked into that room. And when I first got there, though, Wanda was there, and her sponsor were standing on the sidewalk waiting for me. And I couldn't believe it, that, you know, what I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous, alcoholics, you know. And here were these two ladies all dressed up, smiling, happy. They took me into my first meeting, and the funny thing is, a lot of people can't remember their first meeting, and I can remember everything about that first meeting. I remember walking in there and recognizing two or three guys. I wonder where they got to. And I knew the first speaker. It's a step meeting, the group I belong to. But if there's someone new, they have someone talk on step one, or what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I can remember Helen got up and talked, and I couldn't believe it. She was all dressed up, her hair done, and oh man, and that's an alcoholic. So consequently, I went in there, and the funny thing is, I knew that you people had something that I wanted, and I didn't know what it was. You know, so I sat there. And that group, and many, many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, did a lot of things for me in that first year. Because when I walked into that, meeting, you know, they were talking about their lives and how to stay sober. And I have to tell you, at that time, though, our old timer was 5 years sober. And there was 1 4, and a couple that were 3, and most of them, there were 22 people at that meeting. And the other funny thing is, there was 11 ladies and 11 men. And most of them had under 1 year sobriety. But they knew how to stay sober. They were dumb, but they knew how to stay sober. I'll explain to you why they were dumb. They didn't know the rules of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't suggest things to you, to us sensitive alcoholics. You know, I remember going to my second meeting, and this old timer come walking up, and he says, "Look me square in the eye," and he says, "Red, you're no damn good the way you are, you better change." And holy smoky, I was ready to give him one right in the nose. And then I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Just change everything in your life." What a suggestion, you know. Tell me that's the way it's supposed to be. Today I tell people to go to many meetings, and I'm putting everybody I know in Alcoholics Anonymous tells people to go to meetings. That wasn't the way they worked with me. And that was a Wednesday night. I went to a meeting, and Thursday night at supper time the phone rang, and a voice on the other end said, "Red, we're going to a meeting. You come with us." And the thing is, one meeting a week in that town. The rest of the meetings, we had to drive a minimum of about 40 miles. And so they took me to a meeting, a carload of them. Next night after that, the phone rang, supper time, "Red, we're going to a meeting. You come with us." Never once did they say, "Red, you should go to a meeting." They just said, "Come with us." Beautiful thing. And they were real dumb. They didn't tell me to read this book. You know, I was only there for, I don't know how many, maybe a couple of weeks. And they told me, "Red, we're going to form a big book study group in the Ashcroft Library on Tuesday night, and we want to see you there." And so I went there on Tuesday night, and here's 6 intellects. Unbelievable. And we started the big book study group. And we started right from the front cover. And we would read it. But we always had one guy that knew a little bit more. We'd be on page 36, and he would start relating what was on page 136. Sure, it's brilliant, you know. And then we'd get arguing, and we'd get fighting. And we'd get arguing about words that were in his book. We didn't understand. We're all intellects, but there's a lot of words we didn't understand. So instead of arguing amongst ourselves, we decided to buy a dictionary. Can you put your 6 intellect drunks arguing with a dictionary? That's just the way it went. We talked about sponsors today. I was fortunate. I was about 6 weeks sober, and I got my first sponsor, and he was 6 months sober. A lot of people tell me that will never work, and I'm here to tell you it did work. We got to be great friends. We traveled together. We talked about Alcoholics Anonymous on a continuous basis. We listened to tapes. And we did a lot of things wrong, though. You know, and the whole group did at that time. Did a lot of things wrong. And all we send our money to Vancouver Central Office, thinking we're sending to BCUCOM and, you know, a lot of these different things. But, you know, the funny thing is, there's enough traveling bleeding decent around to come there and straighten us out. You know, so there was many, many things when I came. I never came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous either. I came to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I lived on that fellowship for one full year. And it was beautiful. You know, it was really nice. And I had to go up north to work. And when I say north, I'm probably talking maybe a couple thousand miles north of here. And I was working up there. And actually, when you go to a different place in your home group, they do things a little bit different. Everywhere you go, they do things a little bit different. At that time, at my home group, we used to open what to do here. We opened with the Serenity Prayer and we closed with the Lord's Prayer. I went up north to work, and man, you didn't even mention the word Lord's Prayer. You know, and they used to just open the meeting, and then they closed with the Serenity Prayer. And I'd been up there about 3 months, and they said, "Red, it's about time that you chair the meeting." By this time, I was reading Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age. And in there, Bill was saying that one of the essentials of this program is humility. Well, I'm here to tell you, don't go looking for humility. Just hang around this program long enough and it'll find you. I went up there and they said, "What time you chair the meeting, Red?" And I thought, man, yeah, I'll show these guys how a meeting should be run. You know, we do it different in Cash Creek than they did at Fort St. John or Hudson Hope in those places. Actually, Hudson Hope, where this happened. And by that time, I knew the fellows up there who were pretty good talkers. And naturally, they're the ones I asked to speak at this meeting. And man, were they giving a good spiel, and I was sitting there thinking, holy cow, what a good meeting I'm running. So at the tail end, I thought, well, I'll have a grand finale for this. So I announced them that we would close with the Lord's Prayer. You know, they were gracious. They stood up. There wasn't that many of us there, but they stood up. And the funny thing happened. I didn't know the Lord's Prayer. We closed that meeting with a moment of silence. And to me, it was very embarrassing. As I say, don't go looking for humility. Just hang around this program. It'll find you. One form or another. And you know, when you go to a different place and the group traditions are a little bit different, they run the meetings a little bit different. That's not too bad. Come back to your home group and find out they changed. I came back to Cache Creek, and at the end of the meeting, do you know what they were doing? You wouldn't believe it. They were standing up and holding hands and reciting the Serenity Prayer. Man, I couldn't take that. I stood back and I clenched my fists and ready to bat somebody in the ear if they had touched my hand. And I went to work over at Revelstoke, B.C. on the dam there, and I was there 3 years. And over at Revelstoke, they did the same thing. They stood up and joined a circle and held hands. Red had stepped back and clenched his fists and grit his teeth. Anybody touched my hand, he would have got smocked in the ear. After being there for three years, they were having a... I was going there every Wednesday to their meetings there. And they said, "Tonight, we'd like you to stay. We're having a business meeting." And I said, "I have no business going to your business meetings. I've been gone every Wednesday for 3 years." But I said, "I'm not a member of this group. I belong to Cache Creek group. But I have no business at your business meetings." And then I found out that the reason why they wanted me there. And that was because I was a topic of conversation. And they wanted to know if it's group autonomy, how come every time we went to say the Serenity Prayer, you'd step back and clench your fists and grit your teeth? This is group autonomy.
And by God, you know, by that time I'd been around long enough and learned a little bit about traditions. So I started thinking, well, that's a tradition. Maybe I should try it. End of the meeting, I got up and they got up and we held hands. You know, it wasn't near as bad as I thought it was going to be. But you know, I've seen a lot of guys who are just like me. They go to meetings and when they stand up, they won't hold hands, they step back and grit their teeth and clench their fists. For them, I have to let them know today that there is a solution. I tell them that next time you go to a meeting, you look around the hall and you find the two prettiest looking girls there. You sit in between them. End of the meeting, you get up and grab their hands and you bow your head. And if you could pray what you should be praying for, by God, you got her made. Don't go looking for humility. It'll find you. But then there was a time when I got back to Cash Creek and there was some bunch of newcomers came. And you know those people at Cash Creek who had been babying me for that first year? They were neglecting poor old Red. And he was deeply wounded. But you know, they knew what they were doing. They knew it was time for me to grow a little bit in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was 1 year sober before I found out there was a program within the fellowship of this of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was time for me to look into this program. First of all, I had to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. As they say, I was all right being a town drunk, but I didn't really want to be an alcoholic. And I had to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. Want to know where that came from? Chapter 3. In the big book. It says that's the first step of recovery. And so consequently, that was my start on the program within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to get away from the idea that I was an atheist. It was hard. It was not easy. But you know, after this 1 year of being sober, having a good time in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was still walking around with hundreds of unknown fears. I wasn't drinking, but I still had all the fears that I had while I was drinking. And I got to the position where I thought maybe I better get rid of these. You see, I was trying to do it my own. I didn't believe in any power greater than myself. And funny things happened, though. One of these fears was, I don't know why, it was unknown, I don't know anything about it. Except that when the telephone rang, I got a horrible feeling. My stomach would get in knots. The hair on the back of my neck would feel bad. And one day I was home alone, and that phone was ringing, ringing, ringing. Finally, I went to answer that phone, and I don't know why, somehow, I kind of looked up and I said, you know, I can't handle this. How about give me a hand? And I went to the phone and had a real good phone call. I felt good about it. I walked away, feeling delightful. But then again, this thing jumped into gear and it said, what a coincidence. But you know, the next day, the exact same thing happened. The phone started ringing, ringing, ringing. Nobody else was home but me. And as I was walking to it, somehow I said, you know, I can't help this. But I can't handle this. Give me a hand. I didn't know who I was talking to or why I was singing or anything else. Again, I had a good phone message on the phone. And it felt good. I walked away feeling real good. And you know, previous to this though, there was guys that were in our group. And they get up at this podium meeting I go to do. They get up to the podium and someone would even mention the word God two or three times in their talk. And I was sit back there and man, hair in the back of my neck would tingle again, my stomach would get knots, my head would be saying, get away from that. But that was a trap. Because everyone that talked that way are the ones I wanted to be like. I no longer wanted to be like the guys that were like me. I wanted to be like those guys, but I didn't really know how. You know, they were that attraction. They talked about their family life. They talked about the good times they have. Everything was peachy as far as I was concerned, and here I was walking around with all those stupid fears. And I decided then that, by God, maybe I should try this on other things, because I had other fears. One of them was walking out in the main street. Now, I don't know how many people know Ashcroft. It's probably, I don't know, maybe 1,000 people there. Not a very big main street anyway. And I couldn't walk out the main street when I was sober. I just don't know why, just fears. One day I wanted to do it, and I looked up and I said, "Hey, how about giving me a hand?" Who I talked to, I don't know. Why I was saying it, I don't know. Next thing you know, I was out in the main street, and I was talking to people, and I was feeling good. And so I started fishing. Everything that these fears crop up, I would ask for some guidance on how to handle it. And by God, it worked every time. And it amazed me. It just amazed me to no end. You know, and then I got to this idea, well, these things are so good, maybe I better turn my will and life over to this exist God as we understood him. I wasn't using the word God yet. I was using the word higher power. But anyway, I decided this is what I want. And I had a deep desire for this. And so consequently, what really happened was, I thought I had turned my will and life over to care of God as I understood him. I started to use this word God. But the thing is, I was feeling bad. And I had to go and find out what was wrong. So do you know where I went? To my sponsor. My sponsor says, "Well, Red, why is it you're not feeling too good?" And I told him I turned my will and life over to care of God as I understood him. And I always seemed to have the reins back in my hand. And he says, "Red," he says, "what book are you reading?" I says, "a big book." And he says, "Well, it must be written different than mine." He says, "What does step 3 say?" And I said, "It says we made a decision to turn our will and life over to care of God as we understood him." And he says, "What did you say?" And I said, "Made a decision." He says, "Hold it right there." He says, "Maybe you're like me." He says, "In step 3, all that they ask is that you make a decision that you really want this power to run your life, your will and your life." He says, "That's all. Just make that decision." He says, "In my case, I had to work the 12 steps to turn my will and life over to the care of God." And see, so I was way ahead of myself. I didn't know really what I was doing. And anyway, once I turned my will and life over and made the decision, you know, decisions are funny things. God, I used to have to make a decision quicker every morning when I was drinking. I would crawl on my hands and knees to that white porcelain bowl in the bathroom, and I had to make a decision whether to put my head or my back end in it. And most of the time I made the right decision. You know, but that decision of wanting this power to run my life was a great thing, because it allowed me. It was the key that opened the door. It explains that all to me in our literature. I couldn't do it on my own, though. My sponsors, I had 4 of them. I talked about that a little bit today. My first 3 sponsors, each one of them died of a heart attack. Then I got paranoid. The sponsor I have today is over 90 years old, and he has 54 years of sobriety. And to be quite honest, we still communicate, but not like we used to, because he had to communicate with me a lot, especially once I got into the steps. I couldn't understand them, and he was the one that walked me through them. You know, and he told me, he says, there's no way that you can write an inventory until you've thoroughly looked at step 1, 2, and 3. And so we did. And I wrote an inventory, and he was there. And I, first of all, I asked him. And he says, well, have you got a big book? And I said, yeah. He says, it's right in there. I says, oh, I read that. I says, but that's too simple. You know, there must be more to it than that. Because as I read the big book, there was 4 things. And 4 things alone that I had to talk, really talk about. You know, if anybody wants to find it, just look at the example I have of the 4th step in there. And it's just right above there. It tells you the 4 things that of your life that you really have to look into. He says, you don't have to write pages and pages and pages. Because once I start doing that, I went into problems. In red, you know, we talk about meditation in this program. And I'm here to tell you, between meditation and daydreaming, to red, it's a very thin line. And you know, I get into that thinking I'm going to meditate, and my golly, next thing I'm way off in left field. You know, so consequently, this is where my sponsor was to be sitting there and we'd do these things. And it was great. You know, all these different things that were great. And I've had a lot of good experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I still do. And it's wonderful. You know, but what Wes had told me, that second meeting I went to, Red, you have to change. You're no darn good the way you are. And he was right. I had to change everything in my life. Some people may not have to, but I did. I had to change all my thoughts. Because you see, simply, once that I get into the steps and work them through, talk my defects of character, exact nature of my wrongs with another person. I have to talk a little bit about that because it's, again, it gets back to humility. I remember I was working at Fort St. John, that's in northern British Columbia, and I asked this fellow if I could take my 5th step with him, and he said, sure, come on over after supper. And I went over there after supper, and I had my 4-step inventory in my hand. You see, my sponsor was probably, 1,200 miles away at that time, because I was working in out of town. And but I went to this other fellow to take my 5th step. And the reason I picked him, because I thought he was like me. I thought he was kind of leaned towards being agnostic. And I thought, well, that'd be the perfect guy for me to take my 5th step with. But anyway, I went into his house, and it's funny, I started rambling. As soon as I got in the door, I started rambling. And he says, whoa, whoa, whoa. He says, what's going on? I says, well, I've taken my 4th step, I'm taking my 5th step with you. And he says, well, don't we have to do something first? And I says, what? And he says, let's get down on our knees and ask for some guidance on how to do this. Picked the wrong guy. Anyway, we did it. We got on our knees and we asked for guidance. We talked for probably over an hour. Good things came out of me. Things that I didn't know anything about. The exact nature of my wrongs. And once we'd done that, I was feeling good. Man, did I feel good. And so I grabbed my 4-step and started out the door. He says, whoa, whoa, whoa. He says, haven't you got something else? And I says, no. I says, I've done exactly what I want to do. I've taken my 5th step. He says, oh, no. He says, we have to get on our knees and thank him for this. Being allowed to do this. I did it. And it was a good thing. You know, I've had more experiences with spiritual things in this program that are unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. I got smart at one time, and I call it a crash course in Christianity. I went for a retreat for a weekend. And there was a bunch of priests there that were leading us and whatnot. And I come out of there and I didn't know why I had even gone. But you see, when these guys were talking about God at the podium, it was still bothering me. But once I went to the retreat, one of the things it did for me was got it so that I could accept other people and how they talked. And I didn't mind the word God. I went back to my home group and I was all set to tell them about it. But before it was my turn to talk, there was this lady got up the podium and her opening statement was, "Lord Jesus Christ, our Savior," and woof, I had enough problems accepting the fact that people were talking about God. But you know, since that time, I found that, hey, what anybody believes in, that's their belief. What my beliefs are my beliefs. You know, I see my friend Dave and Dee back there. You know, I've known them for a long, long time. They live here, but they lived down the road from me for quite some time. And I know them. They're First Nations people. And there's one thing I didn't know about. My parents were in denial, my mother's side of the family and her and my grandparents. They always claimed to be, I don't know what, most of the time Mexican or Hawaiian or something. They could not accept the fact that they had Indian blood in them. And so consequently, when I was brought up, I used to wonder how come they called me a half-breed once in a while, especially when I was drunk, and I resented it. And today, though, I've accepted the fact what I am and who I am and how I work. You know, it's a great thing. I'm not a status Indian. You know, Canadian government changed all the wording in 1982. They changed it for the people who were Indians or Natives. They started calling First Nation people. The people who were half-breeds, they started calling us Métis. And the people who we were calling Eskimos, they call you Inuit. You see, to me, we're all Aboriginals. And I had to accept that. And it wasn't for this program, there was no way that I could accept that. And I found that I could get back to my culture. And that's what I do today. I'm happy to see people go to church. I'm happy to see people in whatever faith they want to be. My preference today is culture from the Aboriginals. You know, I don't say it for anybody else, but it is strictly for me. You know, we do things that we were condemned that we couldn't do them. Matter of fact, it was against the law to do them for many, many years. But today they open it up and we can do it. We can have our sweat lodges. We can have our ceremonies. We can call this power greater than ourselves the Creator. It's funny, though, as you read this book, how many times you're going to come across that word, Creator? Many, many times. Normally, that's what I call this power greater than myself. Sometimes I call it God. Sometimes they just call it higher power. I hear people say from different religions that there's only one God, and I agree with them. But what people call it is strictly up to them. Whether they call it Creator, whether they call it God, whether they call it higher power, whether they call it Buddha, or Hinduism, or it's strictly up to the individual. To me, they're all the same. They're a power greater than myself. And that's very important for me. You see, by believing these things and doing these house cleaning that I was doing within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I eventually got to be the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found that these fears were leaving me. So it became entirely ready. How did I become entirely ready? By working the 5 steps previous to that. I'm a firm believer that there's a number in front of those steps for a reason. It's not that I've always worked it that way, but when I worked it the other way, in my case, the results were nil. I couldn't do it. People who can do it, my hat's off to them. You know, I'm not against it. But in my case, it wasn't that way. And then I got to the humility part. And I'm here to tell you, I found it long before I got to step seven. Just hanging around this program. It's a good program. It'll do things that I didn't believe in. You know, then I got to make these amends, or make a list of these amends. My first list was nowhere near complete, though. I often talk about this because I have had four sisters, my siblings, and their names were not on the list. And the reason they weren't on the list is because I left home when I was very young, and they're all younger than I am, and they were not around while I was drinking. So I didn't think it was a necessity to have their names on the list. Until I went to a meeting and somebody was talking about it, how they had to put their sibling's name on the list of amends that they had to make. You know, and I had to add their names, my four sisters. And immediately after that, though, I was working in Hope, B.C., and I went, and two of my sisters were on Vancouver Island. One was up at Squamish, and one was over in Alberta. And I had to make a trip and make amends to them simply because of the neglect. You see, the reason I made it was to try and get things right within my life. And it did. You know, before I made amends to them, we never wrote, we never phoned, we didn't visit each other. I was missing a lot. But eventually, after making amends, my God, today we phone each other fairly regularly. Well, on three of them, one passed away. The other one passed away. But the other three, we phone fairly regularly. You know, we get to visit them every once in a while and thoroughly enjoy it. You know, these are the things that were given to me. Strictly given to me. Because I haven't had a drink. Lots of times I go to meetings over and I wonder, where am I sitting? I don't hear anybody say the things that were said to me when I first came in. When I first came in, the biggest thing they told me is, don't drink. They forget that that's the name of the game here. They all think that it's emotional problems or some other problems and whatnot. Granted, they come up and they can be solved as long as they don't have a drink. We wonder about those stupid slogans that we have. You know, how true they are, though. You know, they're a necessity in my life today that I pay attention to them and I try to work them. I'm a firm believer in our basic text. I'm also a firm believer in all our other conference-approved literature. If you want to get a blast, just come to my group with some unauthorized and not conference approved literature, and read still to this day gets irritable, restless, and discontent. And mostly when that happens, man, the talk blows off and I have to do something about it. You know, and these are the things that happen. And I had to make amends to a lot of people. You know, there's some I didn't have to make amends to, which I thought maybe I would. I used to get in a lot of fights when I was drinking. Probably a couple times a week. And you know, the funny thing about the thinking how tough I was and everything else, and I got beat up a lot of times too. But the thing is, you know, when I won a fight, it was about 10 seconds of glory. How good I felt. But when I lost the fight, I would go for months thinking, should I get a 2x4 and get even? Should I pick on his wife and kids? Should I put a few gallons of gas in his nail slot and throw a match in? Those are the ones I have to make amends to. You know, strictly what my thoughts were. It wasn't the action, it was the thoughts. I'm trying to get even. Driving me nuts. And I find that today I don't have to do that. There's a few things I have to do, though. One of the things is I find probably the best for me is working with new people. Everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has got a job. Some run this jamboree and some run camp outs and some run on general service work and some work on one-on-one. And with me, it's one-on-one. You know, I find that there's so many things that I have to do when I'm working with some drunk who wants to quit drinking. Preferably a weapon. You know, there's things that do good for me. Sometimes I cut down on meetings. And I'm here to tell you, though, about that time, this power greater than myself jumps in the gear and it brings me a fresh new one. And if I'm telling them to go to meetings, I better go myself. I haven't got around to this part yet of how it worked with me. I haven't really got around this part of saying, hey, I'm going to a meeting, you come with me. You know, I go with them. Really backwards from the way it was brought to me. But one of these days, things will improve. And even still, I have a couple of buddies. One is 38 years of sobriety, the other is 2 years of sobriety. He's just pigeon. You know. But they pick me up 3 or 4 times a week, and we go to meetings. You know, it's a wonderful thing. You know, but why I say that is because probably right here, people who live here, you could probably go to, I don't know how many meetings in a week, you know, and hardly even drive. We still drive 20, 30 miles, you know, to go to a meeting, and, except for once a week. You know, really, when I look at it, though, I only need to go to meetings once a week. But I have this friend in Hope who says the same thing. He says, I only need to go to one meeting a week. He says, but I go to 4 or 5 because I don't know which one I need to go to. And that's exactly the thing that sits with me. You know, that I'm allowed to do that today. I'm retired. My wife has never, ever complained about me going to meetings. Maybe she did the first couple of months, but I didn't pay any attention. And we find that we both have our own meetings. She identifies herself as a member of the Al-Anon family groups, or a member of Al-Anon. And that's a great thing. It has a lot to do with my sobriety. You see, I found that sometimes in my sobriety, I think I'm doing real well. Again, restless, irritable, and discontent come into the picture. And things won't go quite so well at home. I get bitching and complaining. You know, I get mouthing off. But an amazing thing that I had a hard time understanding, but it works every time. When I'm in that predicament, something happens with her program, and it kicks into high gear, and it carries us through the process of whatever we're going through at that time. It makes us feel good, you know, real good. And I mentioned today, there's some that are here tonight that didn't hear me, but don't think for 1 minute that marriage is a 50-50 proposition. If you do, you're fantasizing. Lots of times our marriage is 95-5. Lots of times it's 5-95. Sometimes it's 50-50. But you know, with these two programs in our home, it balances out. It's amazing how it works. You know, it's just like that first time I answered that telephone. All I have to do is ask for guidance. Ask for guidance on how to do things. And things will work out well. You know, then it got to the point where I had to take a daily inventory. And it wasn't easy for me. You know, some people, they don't have any trouble at all. For me, it wasn't easy. It was very piecemeal to start, but when things weren't going right, it wasn't hard to take a personal inventory, continue to take a personal inventory. You know, when things were rough, I could do it. But then I would go for a few days and things seemed to mellow out, and I'd forget all about it. But eventually, it got more often that I was doing these things. And eventually, it got to the day of repetition that I can take a daily inventory every night before I go to sleep. It tells me in our book about referring back to the things that happened at me. First it talks about upon waking, what to do. Plan my day ahead, but make sure that I ask for guidance. And I do that on a daily basis today. It talks to me about when I retire at night to review my day. I don't know about anybody else, but I still get stuck with self-justification. You know, God, how I can do that. How I can always think that I'm right and everybody else is wrong. You know, so consequently at night when I take this inventory, I find that I have to admit to myself that I was wrong. And then I have to go and admit to other people at times too. This is a daily thing. I got into this prayer and meditation not ever thinking I was going to do it. I had no idea that this is what was going to happen in my life. And so consequently, it was a job. It was a job for me. As I say, I never went to church. I never went to Sunday school when I was a kid. I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and I didn't know any prayers. And I was reading the big book and it says, find a few set prayers. And I thought, lost again. Sponsor of the rescue. He says, look in the book. He says, there's a prayer for step 3. And he says, not only that, there's a prayer for step 7. And he says, if you really want to, he says, in our 12 and 12, there's the prayer of St. Francis in step 11. And you know, I pick them up and they become my step prayers. I use them on a daily basis today. I find that I have a conscious contact with this power greater than myself. You know, one time I had a contact with God. Today I have a conscious contact with the Creator. You see, it just comes with me from repetition within the program. It's a great thing. Meditation is a little bit different thing. As I say, with Red, the difference between meditation and daydreaming is a very thin line. And I had trouble with it. And I had to go to another member of Alcoholics Anonymous who was not my sponsor, and I asked him about it. One time, we were working out in the bush, Bill Morgan Road. And I said, Archie, I'm having trouble with meditation. And he says, you know, Red, I used to have an awful time with that. He says, I had to practice it. I said, how do you practice that? He says, what I had to do is, when I go to a meeting, when somebody is reading chapter 5, I had to pay particular attention to every word that was being read. And the next meeting I went to, I started thinking about it. You know, when chapter 5 was being read, I would listen for 2 or 3 words, and then I'd daydream about something, and I'd say, wonder what's going to happen after the meeting, and wonder about 100 different things. So I had to practice myself. Every time that chapter 5 was being read, I had to pay particular attention. And really what that did, it got me to listen to other people. When somebody is talking at a meeting, I can listen to them. I'm practicing meditation. The reason I was practicing so that I could listen to this power greater than myself. You know? And it's tough. It was tough for me, maybe not for other people, but for me it was tough. Real tough. And then I had an incident happen. I don't like to talk too much about this, but I find that at times I have to. I had a sponsee in Merrick, B.C., which is 40 miles from my home. I call him a sponsee. Normally I don't call anybody that I sponsor a sponsee. I usually call him a pigeon, but I'll call him a sponsee to be kind tonight. We got a phone call at 4:30 in the morning. And they told me that this friend of mine trying to commit suicide. So my wife and I, we jumped into the car and we drove to there, and he'd blown his head off. And I went on a horrible guilt trip. I kept thinking, well, what if I had said this to him? What if I said that to him? What if I'd done this with him? What if I'd done something different? Horrible. Death. You know, just, he had no head left. It was horrible. And I was fortunate, though, I walked out of the house, and the Coldwater River was there, and there was a big rock there, and I went and sat in that rock. And you know what? That's the first time I honestly meditated. And it solved things for me. I'd lost that work trip. I don't really know whether it was anything I said or anything I've done or whether I could have said something or done something different. I don't know. But I got rid of that guilt trip. And that was strictly through meditation. You see, so growing in this program has been wonderful for me. And then they talked about having a spiritual awakening. You know, I couldn't decipher what a spiritual awakening was. I was probably having some and I didn't recognize it. Then I was with a friend of mine, and we went to a meeting, and this fellow got up and he says, "A spiritual awakening is nothing but transformation of thoughts and attitudes." And I had to take that. That's exactly what happened to me. I had to have transformation of my thoughts and of my attitude. To me, that's a spiritual awakening. And I get that as a result of these steps. No other way. That's where it comes from. I'm a believer that I've never completed the steps. I'm a believer that I have to work those steps daily in my life. I'm a believer that sometimes I, you know, like the fourth step, I have to rewrite it. Sometimes I have to look at the list and maybe rewrite it too, of the people I have to make amends to. I believe that it's a continuing program for me. I don't think that I've ever going to graduate, because it's an ongoing thing. And I love the transformation of thoughts and attitude. You know, I feel good about it. And it got so that I can carry this message. Message to those drunks who want to quit drinking. And to those drunks who are at meetings who want to stay sober. Carry this message. This message right here. Don't carry the message, carry this message. That's for me. You know, I wanted to say that I have to apologize to people, quite a few people, because of my story is quite different than some. I especially have to apologize to people from treatment centers because of the fact is I never went to my treatment centers with Alcoholics Anonymous. My detox were grubby hotel rooms, crawling around on my hands and knees looking for another bottle. You know, but people who do go, I find that they're well prepared by the time they get to this fellowship. You know, I don't agree with some of the things they say. When a person tells me that that he's done his fourth step and he doesn't have to ever do it again, I don't agree with that. But that's my privilege. You know, that I don't agree with some of these things. I see other things happening around the program. I don't know what. Probably you've had a lot more problems with it than we have. We're just starting to get into it. We're always way behind everybody else up there. When you live out in the bush, you know, we started having people come to our meetings and they were talking about things other than alcoholism. Man, I would sit there and I'd twiddle my thumbs, have them look up at the ceiling and my eyes would roll back. My head would be saying, get away from that nonsense. You know, though, God looks after these things. Because it wasn't much later than that, I started thinking, you know, how I feel about people talking about things other than alcohol. And then I started thinking, what about those poor people? Having a guy like me sitting there rolling his eyes and twiddling his thumbs and you know, just giving the expression that's not acceptable. How did they feel? God looked after those things, so they started an NA program. Like the same night in the same school. They got those people to go somewhere where they could identify. I'm thankful. They got them out of some of us bleeding deacons' hair. You know, they were at these meetings. And so consequently, I'm really in favor of other prospect programs today. At one time I wasn't. But you know, we can grow on this program. We just keep plugging away at it. And the other thing is, you know, I pray today. They keep telling me to don't put any stipulations in your prayers. I'm sorry to say, but I do in one prayer. I pray on a daily basis that God will send me some drunk who wants to quit drinking. And I put a stipulation in there. I ask him to send me a damn sick dumb one. These half-sick smart alcoholics, they drive me up a wall. Most of the time I have to tell them, go out and practice and then come on back when you get stupid enough. I'm not suggesting you put stipulations in your prayer book. You know, it's just one of my quirks. And the thing is, I see that my phone's still running. Anyway, I'm going to cut a little bit short tonight. I hate to be long-winded. But you know, if anyone in here wants to come and talk to me, they're more than welcome. I have to warn you, though. Don't ask me how I got the way I am, because I'll dump the whole load on you. I'll let you know how Alcoholics Anonymous has done it for me. And you know, as we tread this road of happy destiny, I hope to meet you all soon. And may God bless you until then. Thank you.